Okay, good morning. Was it a long 20 seconds? 25 maybe?
Good enough.
Okay, good morning, welcome to one and all. I hope you've got food, if you need food. There are sheets on the beam in the middle. My aim today is to do probably a little less than a complete daf. My hope is to finish the perek today, and then we'll kind of start with a clean slate next week from the second perek. So really, it looks like I'm only going to do less than an amud, but we're about half an amud behind on the previous daf. So what we'll do is we'll finish off daf vav, and then we'll get up to the new Mishnah, which and next week, you know, it would take me 10 minutes to set up what the new perek is about thematically. So that would kind of add to a buffer. So what we're going to try to do is wrap up the first perek today. Next week we'll start the next perek, and I imagine we'll only do Daf Zayin next week, and we'll finish that off. And if it's a little shorter, I'm sure there will be no grief over that fact. But if it's, you know, if we can go through more than that, we'll try that. But for now, that's what we know. So I'm going to spend about 3 minutes summing up what we've done in this perek, so that we can kind of land the plane, so to speak, of this perek in sentiments that I imagine many have heard in different contexts, but hopefully in this context will come clear. I'm sure we've all heard, oh, a bet din that killed one every 7 years was called a murderous bet din. And out of context, that's used to describe Rabbi Kiva's opposition to the capital punishment. But in this context, I mean, that's true, it seems, but in this context, it's going to have more legs to it as well. And the last sentence of the whole perek seems like an odd way to end, describing what one needs to witness in order to testify against a couple involved in adultery or improper sexual relations. But again, it will culminate in many ways principles that we've articulated over the last few daf. So it's only been nearly six daf, daf Zayin, we obviously start from daf Bet, and the next perek is going to be the same length, and then the third perek is going to be almost double in length, which is all about Malkus, about lashes itself. We haven't even started really talking about lashes, even though this is obviously Masechet Makot. So there are 10 Mishnayot in the first perek, two of which we're going to do today. We've done 8 so far. And the first Mishnah, as we've noted, caused consternation among the commentaries because it has nothing to do with Malkus. And even its purported topic, which is scheming witnesses, Edom Zomamim, it discusses cases. Case of the Edom Nasim Zomim. How do witnesses be classified as schemers? And then it gives examples when they can't be given the verdict or given the appropriate punishment for being scheming witnesses. So again, scheming witnesses. Two people come to court and say, we saw them killing them on Tuesday at 10:45 p.m. in the middle of 188th Street. Then another set of witnesses come and say, you couldn't possibly have seen that. You were with us at 10:45 on Tuesday on 192nd Street. You couldn't possibly have seen that. Turns out those are scheming witnesses, and Edom Zomimim get whatever they intended to happen to their accused. So if they said he killed, they wanted him to get the capital punishment, they get killed. If they said he stole money, they have to pay whatever they accused them of stealing. Which we said established the first theme of this parak, which was, how do we understand justice? Punishment can be read in different ways. Often punishment is really just, at least in Western theories, established to be a disincentive or deterrent. You know, we put people to death, not because we think it's appropriate to kill them, but because we want there to be enough of an incentive that nobody goes around killing because they think they might die. Of course, a lot of research has been done that, you know, for example, a lot of drug crimes used to have capital punishment, and many countries to this day still have capital punishment for drug crimes, and the claim is it's a deterrent. And as people from within that world have testified on occasion, you don't think that kingpins live every day thinking they could get killed. You know, the idea that they might get killed is not a deterrent. So, you know, it's just basically us celebrating by killing people, and it's not a good reason. If there's a reason that they deserve it, that would be a different claim. So usually that's how we understand justice, before we get to deterrent, that there is a punishment that fits the crime. And the most embodied case of that in Jewish law would be Edom Zomim. You intended this, you get that. It's mida keneged mida, what we called in Dante's words contra pasto. I get what I intended. But the Masechet begins with cases where they intended something and we can't give it to them. And remember the first case that we said you can't give to them what they intended? Yeah, they claim that this person is not a kosher Kohen. They're a Ben Grush or Ben Chalutza. So they can't get Aliyot, they can't eat Truma, they can't serve in the Bet Mikdash. We said, well, you can't turn the Edom Zomimim into a, even if they're Kohanim, you can't make them into a Halal, a non-kosher Kohen, because that would then transmit to the next generations. And they didn't do anything wrong. And you can't just give it to them, because that wouldn't be a complete echo of what they intended. So what do they get instead? Makos. So that's the connection to why it's in Masechet Makos, because that's the default punishment that Bet Din hands out in the case we can't give what we intended. And that basically got us off to the races, that justice in Jewish thought is always an approximation. We recognize you can never, ever, ever, in this material plane, give people what they truly deserve, because we're not good at adjudicating what people really deserve. And at the end of the day, we can't always establish what people deserve. Which got us on to the next mission after we issued a number of examples of other exceptions. If somebody says they killed it inadvertently, they need to go to Galus. And then it turns out you couldn't have seen them kill it inadvertently. You weren't there, so they don't have to go to Galus. Oh, maybe we have to send you to Galus. And we said in the Gemara, that's also no exception, because the Pasuk says, Hu Yanus, only that person gets sent to Galus, but nobody else. So scheming witnesses don't go into exile. Or we had three other exceptions where you don't get what you intended. The next missioner said, what about a case when somebody says this person divorced their wife and never paid them their ketubah? So he said, well, you try to cost them 200 zuz. How much is in a ketubah? And of course, the Mishnah pushed back and said, well, not exactly, because eventually, not going to have to, but eventually it's possible he'll have to pay it. Two-third chance. If he passes away first, or if they do get divorced, he'll have to pay the ketubah. But if she passes away first, he doesn't have to pay the ketubah. So there's a two-third chance he'd have to pay it anyway. So all they really intended was to rob him of money that he has a two-third possibility of losing anyway, which again just raises the specter of complication. We said those three lines of Gemara are deemed by some to be the most complicated in the Masechta, basically just kind of mathematics, which we didn't get too deep into. But that, again, deepened the idea that justice is an approximation. What did they really want to cost him? They wanted 200 zuz out of his pocket right now. But they could claim, he wasn't going to have it eternally anyway. It's possible he'd lose it, which raises suspect of how do we determine and execute justice. The next missioner, the third missioner, was if somebody says they borrowed money for 30 days, they owe this guy money in 26 days. And then they turn out and they say, no, we did borrow money, but it's for 10 years. So they were, as Seth said in the last case, they were definitely going to have to give the money back. It was just in a longer period of time. So what were they trying to lose them? It wasn't yours, but it was going to be mine for 9 more years. And that led us in the Gemara into a discussion about Shemitah. Are you able in economic law to kind of have a loophole and decide between you? I know Shemitah cancels all debts, that's what God says, but let's just agree not to cancel it. Can you do that? And we ended up saying, yeah. You can't say in a conversation, hey, I'm going to lend you money and Shemitah won't cancel it, because Shemitah cancels it. You can say, I'm going to lend you money, and we should treat it as if Shemitah doesn't cancel it, and that works. And that led us then into a discussion of if you drop wine into a mikveh, mixed into water and it's diluted, is it really water or is it really wine? And we ended up saying it basically ends up what people call it. If you've got a big vat full of water and you put a little bit of wine in, we said, well, if that goes into a mikveh and we classify it chemically as enough water, it would invalidate the mikveh. If we classify it as wine, it won't invalidate the mikveh. So how do we determine it? And it came down to what people call it. You know, people say, oh, that's diluted wine. So even though chemically it's majority water, it doesn't pass all the mikveh, which led us down again the theme that this is all about consensus. Adjudicating punishment and justice in court is how we run society. It's not always going to fit the crime, because ultimately, where do we get proper justice, so to speak, in what we traditionally call Olam Ha'emet, meaning the world of truth. This is a world where we can't get that. And that led us to a second theme as we got through the fourth Mishnah and then the fifth Mishnah, which was about the difference between false witnesses and scheming witnesses, whether you split cash between the two schemers. If they said he owes $4 million, and then their schemers, do they owe $4 million each, or do they split it between them, $2 million each? And if they said he deserves lashes, do they split the 40 between them? We said, no, you don't split the lashes. You get 40 each, but you split the money. And we spoke about why you might divide it that way. And then we got on to Mishnah 6, which is what many people said. That's how the Masechet should have begun. Mishnah 6 was, so how do you become scheming witnesses? Which you had to already know when you start the Masechet, but that's when it starts. And we said perhaps it was intentional. You don't really get those details until you've already established and rooted in your mind justice is an approximation. We do as much as we can, as best as we can. Sorry, Arthur. Yeah, the 8:30 was cancelled. Sorry. 9 o'clock Hillcrest? Or there's one at the hotel upstairs, I'm told. By the wall. In the main shop. That's my father-in-law's joke. Don't blame me. Sometimes he'll say, this morning I'm davening at the hotel, which means I'm not going to make it to Minyan. I'll daven by the wall in my house. So, the sixth Mishnah established the facts of how you establish scheming witnesses, which is, you were with me. Meaning you can't say that murder never happened because the person you're claiming to be the murderer was with me, so you couldn't have seen it. That is deemed to be false testimony then. We can't rely on your word, but you're not going to be prosecuted as scheming witnesses because you haven't been established to definitely be lying. It's now your word against theirs. You say he's a murderer, they say he's not. We're at a stalemate. But if you say they're a murderer and they say you were with us, literally you couldn't have seen it, you now have been testified about, you become scheming witnesses. Which led us into a discussion. Again, that raises the specter. Is it still their word against theirs? Well, literally, is it their word against theirs? They say, he's a murderer. They said, you can't, you were with us. Do they have any more truth values of what they're saying? No, it's still their word against theirs. So it seems to be a carve-out that if you target the witnesses, you're believed. And it's not a stalemate. And they get in a lot of trouble, which we said makes a massive stakes to testifying. Because you know, in theory, people could come along and say, you were with us. And you will get whatever you intended. It's not just you against them. So testifying is always a massive risk because, you know, whatever you're going to accuse them of, you better be darn sure that you have a tight claim to be there and a way nobody else could disprove it, because otherwise you're going to get targeted with what you get. So that's kind of built in. As we said, in American law, the incentive not to lie is perjury, and there's punishment for that. In Jewish law, there's no earthly punishment for perjury. If you lie under oath as false witnesses, it's a lav she'en bo maaseh. There's no act, so we can't punish you for that. We deem that, you know, that's up to God to deal with. And we won't trust you in court again. So what's the incentive not to lie? So they won't trust me, and I don't believe in God anyway. So I'll go to court, I'll say what I want. But you have to recognize, when you testify, if it turns out that you weren't there and didn't see it, you could get whatever you intend. So you've always got that in mind. That's the incentive, to some degree, not to testify. And we had Rava have three what we would call wild cases, where the flying camels came up. If you said, I saw somebody murder in Hillcrest on Sunday morning, and someone said, that can't be, you were in Teaneck on Sunday afternoon. So we said, well, you have to figure out, could you get to Teaneck from Hillcrest from morning to afternoon? If you could, then it's not a murder. If you can't, then they're scheming witnesses, because they were in Teaneck. They couldn't possibly have been there. And we said, well, what about if they had a helicopter? You know, some people have private helicopters. Maybe they could make it. And we said, we don't care about private helicopters. They call them flying camels. I said, we don't care. If they had some crazy way of getting there quickly, we don't enter that into the evidence. We don't consider it, which we said is crazy. What happens if they had a flying camel? Meaning if they had a helicopter, they could say, there's my helicopter. I'll prove it to you I could get there. So some said, obviously you believe them. And some said, no, we don't include crazy cases. Even if you can prove that you've got eyesight, that you can see nobody else could do, we can't consider that in the evidence. Because how do I adjudicate truth when you've got some exceptional superpower? This is anyone who saw, what was it called? Justice, the Superman versus Batman. What was it called? The Start of Justice or Rise of Justice, whatever it was, Batman versus Superman. And it's always crazy to me that Batman at some point wants to get rid of Superman. So he's helping everything. Why would you get rid of him? And what's Batman's defense? I mean, this guy has too much power. Right now he's helping us, but I don't know what he's doing. I can't give oversight. And to some degree, that's what the Bet Din seems to be saying here, is if you've got superhuman sight that you can see 4 miles, you could say literally anything. And we know you can see because you can prove you can see 4 miles, but you could say, I saw a murder, and we've got no way to cross-examine you. So if you testify and you're relying on that superhuman power, we can put you to death as scheming witnesses if it turns out you were 4 miles away, even if we know you can see that far. Just like Batman wants to get rid of Superman. Your powers cannot work in our justice system because there's no oversight. That's where we got to. And then we got to the eighth Mishnah last week, which spoke about there being no difference between whether you've got 2 witnesses or 3 witnesses or 400 witnesses. Once you are a group, you have equal power, which we said may not be intuitive. You might say, the reason we need two witnesses is because there's a accumulation of trustworthiness. And the more people you add, the more trust you have. You have 15 witnesses, you're more reliable than two witnesses. And the Mishnah said, Shnaim or Shlosha Edim, whether it's two or three, it works, which the Mishnah took to mean it doesn't matter whether you've got two or 1,500 witnesses in a group. Once you've reached the two threshold, that's all you need. And it's your word against it. You can have 1,500 people testifying and two people disagreeing, and the two win. And if two come along, we said, and say, you 1,500 were all with us at a massive party where there were 1,502 guests. You couldn't possibly have seen that. What happened? They all get put to death as scheming witnesses on the word of the two. That was where we got to last week. That was the first, what led us into the beginning of Daf Vav. And then we established how do you put these groups together, which led us on to Daf Vav Amud Bet, where we're going to start at the top. And again, we pivoted theme from justice being approximation to also truth being impossible to establish. Again, I said this probably ad nauseum, so forgive me, but as we finish the perek, I'll stop saying it by next week, which is, contemporary life in court, oftentimes, people want to find the truth. In the FBI, they say, you can find the truth. We will unearth the truth. Justice will be done. And the overall theme that we have established through this first perek is, that's not a guarantee. Don't rely your hopes on that. There are some things that we will never, ever know the truth. And probably, maybe I'm wrong, probably one generation ago, that was assumed that you can never find the truth. You know, before DNA, before fingerprint evidence, before forensic science in many ways, the idea that we can always really find the truth was probably a distant hope. Sometimes we never know. You know, now there are cold cases from 30 years they find out with forensic evidence that hopes had lost. But we're now at a point where we believe we can find it. Michael pointed out to me last week, there's now, what's it called when they can make the video of people speaking? Deepfakes. And then he came to me at the end with a picture of me looking like I'm 85, because there's an app on your phone, you can put it on, called Face App, where you upload a face and you can age it, make it younger, change the gender. So he showed me a picture of a female me giving the Daf HaShavua Shir, which I imagine was a somewhat odd idea. But technology has become so sophisticated. I pointed out to him, there's now an Israeli firm that can manufacture DNA evidence. Which we thought was impossible. If you find DNA at a crime scene, that puts you at the crime scene. There's now an Israeli company that can manufacture DNA. So now DNA doesn't work. So we're now back at a point. There you go. He's shown the picture of me as a female giving a shit. I was an old man. You wanted to save that. Thank you.
This all reminds me of the son of the old Yiddish fellow who actually was in court testifying, and it was a crime at night.
Yes.
So the defending counsel said, it was late at night, you're elderly, how can you be sure that you saw 25 metres away that so-and-so did so-and-so?
Just before you say the punchline, are you 100% sure you're comfortable saying it?
Yeah.
Okay. Am I going to be comfortable with you saying
no.
it? This is recorded. Yes.
Okay, so I can see the moon. Is that far enough?
Oh, right, there you go. Thank you. I mean, to some degree, this reminds me of the movie The 12 Angry Men. Has everybody seen 12 Angry Men? Which, in many ways, comes to establish what we've been saying, which goes to the heart of the judicial system. And the claim at the end of the movie isn't that, obviously, he was innocent, but in theory, you can question everything. And it comes to one point that one of the witnesses on the stands, I think one of the foremen says, did you see the little marks on the nose? And they said, oh, I did see that. And they, well, obviously they wear glasses. Why didn't they wear them to court? And they said, well, maybe they didn't want to. Oh, I can't see anything. Maybe they didn't want to look, you know, they're old. It would make them seem feeble and vulnerable. So they didn't wear them to court. But if they, who sleeps with their glasses? And the guy with the glasses says, no, I take them off at night. So it was the middle of the night. He woke up, he looked out and he saw through a moving train, a murder happened. And that's the witness we're relying on. And basically the case starts to fall apart until there's one angry guy left who ends up that he's really angry with his son for not talking to him for the last 3 years. And that's why he wants this young person to go to jail. And the whole case falls apart. And it goes one by one by one, showing that at the beginning, 11 were willing to put this guy to death. And one guy sits there and questions everything they went through till they establish that, I don't know. There's now reasonable doubt. And it seems to be, in Jewish, there's always reasonable doubt. So how can we ever do anything? And to some degree, that's where we're going to end up, with Rabbi Akiva saying, I would never put anybody to death. I would always ask a question they can never answer, which seems to put justice in an odd place, which is where the Masechet's going to finish by saying, even though Rabbi Akiva said that, that's not actually where we land. Because society couldn't function. If we were all functioning like the 12 angry men, no one would ever get convicted of anything. And society would fall apart. So, top of Vav Amud Bet. Hayushneim. If there were two, Rohan Ota Machalon Zev, Shneim Rohan Machalon Zev, there were two groups of two, one on each side of a street, different windows. One saw a murder in the middle of the street from one window, one saw a murder in the middle of the street from the other window. This is Vav Amud Bet at the top, the Mishnah. Ve'echad matrebo be'emtzan, somebody issues the warning in the middle of the street, middle and 188th Street. Someone says, don't kill, you'll be put to death, it's forbidden. And there are two witnesses in the youth department window, two witnesses in the Itzkowitz home looking into the street. The Mishnah says, Bizman shemik satan roin elu et elu. If the two witness groups could see each other, hari elu edet echat, it is one group. Ve'im lav, and if they don't see each other, hari elu shtei eduyot. They are two groups of witnesses, which sounds like a very pedantic divide. Obviously, our message didn't get around, which I feel a little bad about. Not a minion, so I'm not that, don't feel that bad about it. But there's
a minion. I'm sure I saw 10 people.
Yeah, well, you can see to the moon. So, Vimlav Hari Elu Shtei Eduyot, which again, it sounds like a very technical issue. Is it two groups, one group, who cares? And what we're about to establish is, well, they care, because if they're two groups, it's possible some of them will be put to death. If they're two groups, so you've got two again in the shul, they can see into the street. Two into the Itzkowitz home, they can see into the street. And all four testify that we saw somebody kill somebody in the street. We saw Reuven kill Shimon in the street. Then two other witnesses come along and say, oh, well, the two people in the shul, they couldn't possibly have seen that. They were with us. So now what are they? They're Edom Zomimim. They try to get somebody killed. They should get killed. If it's one group of four people, only two of them are deemed to be scheming, what happens to the four?
Nothing.
Nothing. They all need to be deemed schemers to get punished. If it's two groups, and it turns out those two are accused of being Zomim, what happens? They get put to death. And who else gets put to death? The murderer, because the other two are kosher witnesses who testified that there was a murder. So you've now got two witnesses who were believed, a murderer who's killed, two witnesses who testified to something that was true. There was a murder. We believe the other witnesses, but because you weren't there, you get killed. So if you're one group, you're saved. So it all depends if you can see the other witnesses. So before you become schemers, you should think about where you're standing and if you could see other witnesses from there, in which case you'd be saved.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Isn't it true that the witnesses also have to be the ones that are giving the warning?
No. So there's going to be a view that says that in about three lines. That's not where we fall down. But there is a view that says that, and that'll be part of where we get pushback in the Gemara, because that would establish we're not even trying to get the truth now. We've made it such a formality in court that I need two witnesses, they're the ones who issue the warning, they're the ones who see it, and we're going to kind of see Rava and others in the Gemara, and the Gemara's going to finish before the next Mishnah, with a very odd, seemingly disconnected case that seems to push back now, because we've gone so far in saying we can't get to the truth, so the whole thing seems to be an artifice at some level, so we need to kind of push back and find some middle ground. So there'll be two views. There'll be one view that even a demon can give Hasra. And another view that says you actually don't need a Hasra. What's the whole reason you need a warning, by the way? If someone's about to break Shabbos and I say, don't break Shabbos, you'll get in trouble. What are the possible reasons why I might need somebody to give a warning to someone?
So they know what they're doing is wrong.
Meaning, so it's about establishing state of mind. Okay. Meaning, I need to make sure that your intent, that's one possibility. If that's true, technically speaking, do I need a Hasra? If they were in a Shir that morning, and they know, and we know that they know that you can't break Shabbos, they spent their whole life doing that. Do they need a warning?
Maybe they thought it was Sunday.
So maybe they thought it was a wrong day. So if they were in Shul that morning and said, Hayom Yom Shabbos, so you know that they know it's Shabbos. Do they need a warning? No, I mean, technically, you could always find a way to say maybe they had a break of, right. you know, a mental break. Who knows? But that's also true. If you give a warning, someone could have a mental break. You say, I know, and then they do it anyway. The other possibility is we're just trying to limit how often we give out punishment. So we need to make it almost impossible for someone to get in trouble. And that's where it sounds like we're going. If you say the witnesses have to give the warning, that's crazy, right? I mean, somebody else could stand and say, don't kill, it's problematic. And the witnesses see this. We say, you can't take that to court because the witnesses didn't issue the warning. That would be not about establishing intention. That would be something to do with the witnesses having immense power and just formally overseeing this event. Almost like a wedding where we say you need witnesses to be appointed to make it formally happen. The witnesses are almost creating this event. And that's going to be one view in the Mishnah. So the Mishnah continues, if it's one group, they can see each other, they can't see each other, it's two groups. First word of the line is Edu Yot. Lefikach im nimsa et echad mehem zomemet. And if it turns out that there are two groups and you find one group are schemers, hu vehe neheragin v'shnei p'tuya, the two witnesses who are still kosher are believed, and the murderer and the schemers are put to death. Rabbi Yossi says, Roni Vula olam ein neheragin, you don't put anyone to death, achu shnei edav matrimbo, until the two witnesses themselves offer the warning, as it says, al pishnaim edim, it is by the word of two witnesses we put people to death. So they have to be the ones to issue the warning. Dava acher, an alternative explanation, which is followed halachically, al pishnaim edim, what does the verse mean when it says by the word of two witnesses people are put to death? Shalota he sanhedrin shomer mamaturagaman, you do not have translators in court, which we said makes for people who don't speak the native language, this now makes justice almost impossible. You cannot have interpreters in the courtroom, which is not the case in American law. They have interpreters all the time in court cases. But that seems to be the little bet there right next to that. Tells you that that's cited halachically by the Rambam and often the Shulchan Aruch as well. Now we're into the Gemara. We actually said these couple of lines last time. The Gemara says, hold on a minute. How do I know Edut Meyuchedet doesn't work? An Edut Meyuchedet is, how many witnesses do we need for a case? Two. What if there are two witnesses, but they didn't know that each other saw it? One was standing in a market, one was standing at home, and they both saw something happen, and they came out to the street and said, I can't believe it. Did anybody see that? And the police go around looking for witnesses, and they find two people who saw it, but they couldn't see each other, and they didn't know they both saw it. You've got two witnesses. Can they come to court? So we're not...
One person each or two?
One each. So now that's called Edut Meyuchedet, meaning there are two, but they're in separate places. And the Gemara says, and the Mishnah says, that don't work. You need to be physically a group. You need to be able to see each other or together. And we're going to get to how extreme this is in one moment. How do I know it doesn't work? Shneimar, as it says, Lo Yumat Al Pi Echad. You can't kill by one witness. And if you look to the right margin of the page where it says Torah Or HaShalem, there's a little aleph there and there's a pasuk. And that pasuk says, Al pishnaim edim ashlosha edim yumat hamet. You put to death by two or three witnesses. Lo yumat al pi ed echad. You don't put to death by one witness. And the Gemara is going to say that seems redundant. It says you need two or three and you can't use one, obviously. So why does it say you can't use one? That's where it's going. My echad, what does it mean you can't use one? First word in the line is echad. Ilema aid achad mamash. If you think it means literally you can't use one witness, Mereisha Shamin Allah. We already know that Apishnaim Adam. It says you can't use two witnesses. Elamai Echad, what does Echad mean? Echad Echad. It means one and one. You can't put to death by means of two separate witnesses. Tanya Namaha, we have a brighter that says the same thing. You can't put to death by one witness. This is exactly the case. Two from windows don't see each other. Shane and Starfim, they don't combine together. Flo Od, and not only that. And this was our the most extreme case. Afilu b'zeh achazeh b'chalon echad ein mitzarfin. Even if they are literally, if we were all standing in this room, and there are, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 of us, we're all standing in this room, and to see out something happening out that window, you have to stand exactly here. And I said, oh my gosh, guys, there's a murder here. We need more than just me. Everybody come line up. We'll have 17 of us. I'll look, and then you'll look, and then you'll look, and 17. But we never saw it at the same time. We're not one group. And it won't, that's Edom Yechere. It does, you can't take that to court. You have to literally all see it at the same time, the group of two. So we've said again, you're in the same room, you've watched it, but if you're not together, so it sounds very much like we're not even interested in truth now. We're just interested in saying, how does justice work? We need two witnesses. That's what the Bible says. You both need to see it and it's done. So we can have a little bit of pushback that it is about truth. We recognize you can't always find it, but we are trying to limit it and find the truth. But now the Gemara is going to say, hold on a minute. Amalei Rav Papa Abaye. You've just told me you can't see from, you can't combine witnesses looking from one window one after the other. If there were, let's say there was a murder, could you give me a good explanation of why we wouldn't want to combine two witnesses one after the other looking for a window if they're testifying against a murder?
Can't see the same moment in time.
And how long does it take to commit murder? I mean, let's not get imaginative about ways to kill.
A moment.
Yeah, there is one moment where somebody is killed. Again, you could see a struggle ensuing for a long time, but there is a moment when somebody dies. And unless you are testifying that I saw the moment they died, you can't say I saw them kill them. You can say I saw them strangling them, I saw them doing horrific things to them, but all that could happen and the person not die. There's only one moment when somebody dies. So obviously you can't combine two witnesses because they wouldn't both have seen the murder. That's what Rav Papa is going to say. Hashta, hold on a minute. You told me, Uma echad mechalon zeh, vech mechalon zeh, dehai kachazi kulam ma'aseh, vehai kachazi kulam ma'aseh, amr slam istarfe. You've told me the two witnesses from different windows who see the whole event unfold, they don't combine. Well, obviously, you wouldn't say when they see half the event each, they can't combine. Obviously, you might have thought being in the same room is better, but of course it's worse if they can only see half the event. The Gemara says, we're talking about a case that is like sexual impropriety. Where, and the basic premise here is the crime is protracted, that you could both see the crime being performed. Murder, it's right, there is a moment when somebody dies. But for example, in sexual intimacy, it could be protracted. It wouldn't be like, oh, you saw the moment of crime and I didn't. And there are other sins, like this could be breaking Shabbos, carrying on Shabbos, you carry along the street, is protracted. And the reason this example is given seems almost arbitrary, but it's going to be how the Masechet ends, which will establish, again, how truth works in court. We'll get to that. Again, Amar Rava. Rava, and we're going to have a series of statements of Rava who pushes back against this notion that it needs to be very limited who gives warning. Amar Rava, Imhayurone Tamatro, Matro Vero Temnit Starfin. He says, unlike the Mishnah, the Edom don't have to see each other, they just have to see the warning. And if they both see the warning, they're one group. And then they can all kind of go in and they go down, we will all go down together. That's Rava. Amar Rava, and Rava says, Matre Sha'aru, and that warning we talk about, Afilu Mipi Atzma, Afilu Mipi Shade. It can be a warning they give to themselves. If I'm the murderer, I can stand up with a knife and I can say, I know murdering is prohibited, and I know if I kill, I'll be put to death, and I'm doing it anyway. Boom, the person's dead. According to Rabbi Yossi in the Mishnah, you can't be prosecuted because the Edom didn't give the warning. According to Rava, if he knows, we've established a state of mind. And by the way, that's the backdrop to the whole of the next perek, which is all about intention, unintentional, accidental. So we're already teasing out those themes. That's Rava. And even a demon can give the warning. We don't need to talk about Shadim, but they feature inconvenient moments when we're looking for a non-human version. Which, what could we say today, you know, can give the warning if we didn't want to say Shade, you know, don't hear from... Yeah, you could say Alexa. You know, if, you know, Alexa, I think, was in the news last week because it's costing Amazon a huge amount of money and it's become unpopular, mainly because people started realizing that the CIA is basically listening to everything you're doing in your house. But you could imagine Alexa, you know, suddenly realizes a murder is happening and say, you should know that's against penal code 305. You will be taken to jail. Like, no witnesses said it was just Alexa. So Rava says, Alexa can give the warning. As long as we know what you've done is problematic, you can get prosecuted. Rav Nachman says, Eidet miyuchedet kasher b'dina mamanot. He says, well, this whole idea that two witnesses need to be formally part of a group, that's only when it comes to capital crimes. But when it comes to monetary crimes, it's still kosher and it works. And that little hey, by Rav Nachman's name, tells you that that's what we follow to the law, that separate witnesses works in monetary cases, which is going to be a problem in a minute. How do I know it works in monetary cases? Because it says, lo yumatapi echad, you don't put to death by one witness, but didn't in a far shot, who the ink shera, didn't a monic shera. So it works in monetary cases, but not in capital cases. Makila Rav says, hold on a minute. When it comes to capital cases, there is a principle in Jewish law. We do as much as we can to avoid putting people to death. We don't want to kill people, which is a reasonable contention because, as we've established, we don't always know the truth. So we're going to do our best to avoid putting to death. Elama'ata, and now that you've just told me that Edom Yuchedet works in monetary cases, you're telling me that we do rely on those witnesses as telling the truth. So I get that we wouldn't want to put people to death on that basis. Lo yumat al bi'echad, you wouldn't put to death by one witness. But why wouldn't you save people's lives and say that's a reason enough not to put to death? But then in a farsha, tatzal, maybe it should work to save. What case would that work to save? We've said two witnesses from one window, two witnesses from the other. They can't see each other. Eidah miyuchedet. So he said they're the two separate groups. So if they're accused of being schemers and they're believed, who's put to death? The schemers and the murderer. We said, well, if Eidah miyuchedet works for monetary matters, why don't we say Eidah miyuchedet should work, put them together as one group, and then they're schemers, we don't trust anything, and no one's killed. Save the day. And what's the Gemara's answer? Just says Kasha. Many observe, we follow Rav Nachman, that it works in monetary cases, and we follow the rule that Eidah miyuchedet doesn't work in our case. So the Kasha here seems to be more like, yeah, life is hard, rather than this case is difficult to resolve. Meaning, yeah, we're doing our best to maintain integrity in monetary law, in capital law, but at some point you've got to draw the line. Full stop, Rabbi Yossi said. Now, Rabbi Yossi said the warning has to be issued by the witnesses themselves, which makes it, again, sound like a very formal requirement. This is not about establishing their intent, because you can establish their intent with Alexa. Why do I need the witnesses to do it? Because it's formal. Amar of Papa. Rav Papa said to Abaye, again, he appeared earlier up on the Daf, Rabbi Yossi doesn't think that. Now, we got another Mishnah where Rabbi Yossi said, Hasone nehareg mipishu kumuad mutra. If we know there are two people, and everybody knows they're kind of antagonists, lifelong enemies, every time one walks into the room, one kind of harumps out and they never see each other, they don't invite you to simchas, kamsan barkam, so that's who they are. And it turns out that there was no warning issued, but two witnesses saw kamsa kill barkamsa. Do we assume that it was on purpose? Do we assume it was by mistake? Do we assume he knew what he was doing? If you're Rabbi Yossi in our Mishnah, it shouldn't matter. The witnesses have to give the warning. But the Rabbi Yossi in this Mishnah seems to say, if you are an antagonist, you don't need a warning. If you kill somebody, we know you meant it. We know you've been seething for years. And if you... Right. Now that we know you've got a motive and kind of a visceral inclination, what do we assume you need to do? And this is going to be another principle of Jewish justice, which is, if you know you hate somebody, what do you, as the person who hates them, have to spend your life doing when you're near them? Restraining yourself. You need to know, I'm on the verge of killing this person every time I see them. Which is why the Gemara says, we know people are like that. And that's why you don't need a warning. If you kill them, we know you meant it. So actually, we have to spend our time around our enemies being even more guarded. Because we know we could fall into that trap. That's Rabbi Yossi's view in the Mishnah. So that doesn't square the Rabbi Yossi in our Mishnah. Amalei hahu Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda. Oh, that's a different Rabbi Yossi. That's Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda. He, the Tanyan, he taught to Rabbi Yossi bar Yehuda, as we see in another brighter, Chaver ein sarech hatra. What's a chaver? I would think a friend, and I didn't understand this at all, so I had to check into it because Rashi doesn't comment. Say again.
Maybe an enemy, the reverse.
So that was my second instinct, but... So yeah, it turns out it's more of a yeki chaver. You know, if someone gets called up ha-chaver, it doesn't mean the friend. It means, you know, an important person, a scholar. So a scholar doesn't need a warning. Meaning if somebody's a trained Supreme Court justice, they can't say, I didn't know. So, well, you do know. We know you know. You've written papers and given lectures about this. So a chaver, if somebody is a scholar, ein sarech hatra, they don't need a warning. Levishlo nitna hatra et lalahavkim in shoglamei. The whole point of a hatra is to get your intention on the record. Do you know what you're doing? Which again is setting up the whole next perek about going to exile. If I kill someone, how do I know if you meant it, didn't mean it, accident, intentional, non-intentional, full stop, davar acher. We had the end of the Mishnah that says, we don't follow Rabbi Yossi that you need the witnesses to warn, but we do need to hear in court from the witnesses themselves. No translators in the court. After the grey, hanau la'uze da'atu lakame da'rava. There were these la'uze. What is a la'uze? Le'uze means foreigners, as will sometimes Rashi will say, la'az, which means in the foreign tongue. So, Le'uze, you had these foreigners come to court before Rava, and Rava keeps featuring here. Uki Rava turgam on benai, when Rava put an interpreter in. Everyone says, Rava, we said you can't have interpreters in court. Ve'heichi avidachi, how could he do that? Hatnan shlotei sanhedrin shema pitogam. We said you can't have interpreters. Rava, this is the answer. Rava meidahava yada madahava amri. Rava knew what they were saying, and I'm sure many of us, maybe it's just me, but many of us have this experience. People say to me, you know, do you have fluent Hebrew? My answer is, I can understand, but I'm not very good at speaking. If, you know, if I had to give a speech in Hebrew, I would have to spend a lot of time preparing it in advance if I wasn't just using the same four verbs in different ways. But if someone's giving a lecture in Hebrew, I can listen to it. So rather saying, I knew what they were saying, but I had the interpreter there, so I could, and the interpreter could convey what I meant to them. He knew what they said, but he couldn't return in the language, and that's why he had the interpreter, and that's fine, because I didn't hear from the interpreter, I just used the interpreter. And this is renowned to Zion, and we're heading towards the end of the Perek now. Ilava Tuvia, we have a case where there were these two witnesses, Ilava Tuvia, Kruvi Da'aravaha, who were related to the guarantor. Anyone here ever been a guarantor in a legal case? Anyone familiar with a guarantor? When there's a loan between two parties, one of the parties says, I'm going to borrow $1 million from you, and the other party says, well, that's a lot of money. What happens if you go bankrupt? I still want my money back. I need a guarantor who will pay me back if you don't. Anyone ever been a guarantor? You have. Actually, there was a lot of money involved.
Yeah.
It was when they sold Chametz in Chicago, correct, which was quite a lot of money because it was for the whole of the Chicago Orthodox community. And it turned out if he wouldn't have been able to pay, I would have inherited nothing. Put it that way. Guarantors are involved. So now the question comes up, what happens if there are two witnesses and the lender and the borrower are not related to these witnesses, but the guarantor is related to the witnesses? Would you say the witnesses can't be involved? Meaning the actual transaction is between two parties with overseeing it, we're not related. The guarantor happens to be related, but he's not involved right now. I'm just dealing with the case between the borrower and the lender.
They are involved.
Okay, so you all seem to agree with where we fall. One was if he's related, Savar of Papala. I mean, Rav Papa thought to say, Gabi Lovavalov and Rechike Ninu. They thought to say, well, the actual transaction is not related. Of course, they can oversee it. And again, if the principle is the Adim, this is not about capital T truth. This is about social principles. And the witnesses are formal figures who give warnings and oversee cases and have all the power. So it shouldn't really matter what happens down the line. They oversee the transaction and they're reliable for that. But Rav Huna Breid Rav Yeshua says to Rav Papa, no, that doesn't work. Because if the borrower doesn't have money, love but arva azumal v'shul, they're going to go after the guarantor. He's part of the case. Meaning, we do care about the unintended consequences, the legal ramifications. We can't just live in a kind of airy-fairy world where legal cases are adjudicated on the spot, warnings are given, we establish intent, and it's given, and then we say, doesn't matter whether it's true or not. What was the most extreme case where we said, capital T truth doesn't feature? The most extreme case was if somebody is given the verdict that they're going to be put to death, they're now legally dead. And if you kill them, you walked up to somebody who was just given the verdict. This is John Grisham, was it Time to Kill? Anyone see that movie, Time to Kill? I think Samuel Jackson's in that, where there are two young men who are accused of raping and I think killing his daughter, or maybe not killing, but yes, killing? No, I think she's recovering at home. And he goes into court after the verdict is passed and he shoots them. And then the whole trial is about, can you call him insane by product of his emotional turmoil or is he guilty? And it's in the South, racism or whatever it is. So if somebody is then on the stand, verdict is passed, you're going to be executed tomorrow. And then the family says, I really can't stand that guy. I'm just going to go kill him. Legally, you can't be held culpable because they're dead legally since the verdict has been passed. That was the most extreme case where we said capital T truth doesn't really feature as the bottom line in the judicial system. But what we've been pushing back is it's not the bottom line, but it is part of the discussion. We don't just make things up and say, if you hit technically the point, we'll put him to death. Truth is important, even if we know we can't always get there. So this seems to be some manifestation of that, where I know he's not related to the two involved with the transaction, but he's related to the guarantor, and just use your head. He's going to come into it, possibly. So we should think about that. Last Mishnah of the Perek.
It's a silly question, probably, but for Rava, who says that the witnesses do not have to be the one
giving the warning,
the Gemara uses the language that ein roin es hatra. Why don't they say the ein shomin et hatra?
It's a good question. I guess seeing is the key to testimony here. Which would raise the question, if somebody doesn't...
I don't know what, I mean, if you just see somebody talking to the guy and say, and do you know what he really said?
Oh, meaning you had to see, presumably you had to hear too.
If you just hear, how do you know it was that?
Right, you'd have to hear and see, presumably.
Both.
Right, so that's presumably, it's being inclusive. If it just said hearing, you'd say, oh, you just need to hear. I could be in the room next door, I hear a warning, and that's it. So it's saying you have to see, meaning obviously you have to hear, but you have to see as well. So I don't think it's a silly question, but I think it's a helpful clarification. Okay, last mission. Mishenigma dina uvarach. If somebody, the verdict was passed, you will be executed. Uvarach, and they fled. I don't think that happens very often anymore, because usually they put you in cuffs and they say, bailiff, take him to a holding cell, whatever. But in the old days, they'd say, we're going to be executed, so come back tomorrow. Okay? So they ran away. But then they came back before the same Beit Din. Why would they come back? The assumption, the commentator, is they were caught and then brought back. Not they're like, I feel bad. I've come back for my execution. Comes back to court. Ein sotrinet dino. We do not open the case again. You know, if somebody runs off and they get brought back, in theory, somebody might say, you know what, there's been a gap between now and there. Let's revisit the case. Maybe we'll find a way to get them off. And again, we've got that principle. We do whatever we can to get them off. So it turns out, the Mishnah says, we don't revisit the case. The verdict has been passed. Nothing has changed. That's it. And if you've got a case where two witnesses come along and say, we saw this person, he was given a verdict in certain court, and these two were the witnesses, we put them to death. And the question will be raised, what does that add? It seems to be the same as we don't reopen a case. That's it. So we'll come to that in the Gemara. Sanhedrin oheget ba'aretz v'chutz la'aretz. And there's a principle that the Sanhedrin works in Israel and outside of Israel, which again gives some sort of indication. This isn't just about formal judicial institutions. Even outside of Jewish control, formal control, when you're out in the diaspora, we still try to adjudicate justice. We still try to maintain truth and hold people accountable. It's not just a formal artifice of institutions in a polity. Sanhedrin ha'areget, and then we got the end of the Mishnah. Sanhedrin ha'areget echa b'shurinit kran chuvlanit. If a Sanhedrin killed once in 7 years, they were called chuvlanit, vicious, aggressive. Rabbi Lez ben Azariah omer, and Rabbi Lez ben Azariah say, and what is he saying? Echad l'shivim shana, no, one in 70 years. So the Gemara is going to say, what is Rabbi Lez ben Azariah saying? One in 70 years would be called brutal, or one in 70 years is the appropriate amount? Meaning one in seven is brutal. What's the appropriate amount? One every 70 years. The Gemara is going to not know the answer to what he means there. Rav Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva omrim. So you've got Rav Tarfon and Rabbi Akiva, saviors of the accused. Ilu hayinu b'Sanhedrin. If we were in the Sanhedrin, lo neragadu me'olam, no one would ever be put to death. Rav Shimon Gamliel comes along and says, thank you very much, Rabbi Akiva, defenders of the righteous. You're just going to lead to more murders. Why would they lead to more murders, by the way? If they say, no one's ever going to be put to death, why are you going to lead to more murders?
No accountability.
Right, meaning everyone thinks I'm never going to be put to death. So it sounds like he's raising the deterrent issue, which is if you don't put people to death, people are going to murder more. It's also possible, if somebody's guilty of murder and we don't put them to death and they go about their life, what might happen as a result, putting aside crimes that are disconnected?
Do it again.
They might do it again, or... let's say they've decided that they're going to repent. They're never going to do anything wrong again. Anything else might happen if we don't put them to death?
Vengeance.
Yeah, maybe other family members will come along and kill them. Meaning, it could be, Rav Shimon Gamliel is not saying deterrent is the issue. He's just saying, if you don't adjudicate justice, you're just inviting vigilantism. Say, well, the court's not going to do it. I'm going to take it into my own hands. And we see this in America all the time. There are these, and it happens in Israel too. If there are political groups who feel that certain things are unjust and they feel like institutions aren't taking care of it, people feel like, I need to take care of it myself. This isn't being properly adjudicated. And Rav Shimon Gamliel seems to be saying, Rabbi Akiva, you seem very sympathetic. You don't want people to put to death. But actually, you're just going to make society untenable. Not just whether the deterrent issue, but everyone's going to take justice into their own hands. Lifnei Gemara says, hold on a minute. You said if they go before the same Beit Din, we don't reopen the case. That sounds like if they fled and they went before a different Beit Din, we would reopen the case. Lifnei Oto Beit Din Hu Dein Sefer, we don't reopen the case in the same Beit, but it sounds like we would do it in front of another Beit Din. But Hatani Sefer, the very next line in the Mishnah said, you've just said, if he comes before the same Beit Din, we don't reopen the case. And any time there are witnesses to say he had a test, he had a verdict pass, he's put to death. What happens if he goes before a different bet din? It sounds like they're at odds with each other. So the Gemara is going to say, good. The first bit and the second bit are talking about different cases, and there is actually an exception. There is one time where if somebody flees and comes before a different bet din, we do reopen the case. In what case would that be? The Gemara says, Amar Abaya, Lo Kasha, the first one on the line is Neharik, says Amar Abaya in pink. Abaya says, Lo Kasha, no problem. Kan Baritz Yisrael, Kan Bechutz Laretz. Depends where it's in the diaspora or the land of Israel, as follows, Tanya, as it was taught in a brighter of Yud Ben Destai, Omer, he said, Mishim Rishim Ben Tach, and then Mishim Ben Shetach. Barach Me Aretz Lechutz Laretz. If somebody is found guilty in Israel, and they run to the United States, and come before a Jewish court in the United States, Ein sochin et dino, we don't reopen the case. The verdict's passed, you're guilty, full stop. The chutz laretz says, well, if they were found guilty in the United States and they fled to Israel, to a different court, sochin et dino, we reopen the case. Why do we reopen the case? Mipnei zechuto shel eretz Yisrael. Because of the merits of Israel, or the land of Israel. Now what does that mean? Yeah, we don't have the time to adjudicate all the possible readings of that. But there's an assumption, if you have fled justice outside of Israel, and then you go to Israel, there is something meritorious about being in the land of Israel, it seems, that maybe we'll find a way to get you off. And again, Zechut HaShel Eretz Yisrael means the merit of Israel. It might be some metaphysical thing that, oh, in Israel, maybe providence will align differently, which has all sorts of, you know, theological consequences and baggage to it. Maybe the judges are going to be wiser because in Eretz Yisrael there's some, the Avira Eretz Yisrael Machkim, that the land makes you smarter. Maybe just being part of Jewish political institutions, meaning it's going to be more reliable. The bureaucracy is better than if you're in some bet din out there in the middle of the world without real power. All sorts of possible explanations, but that is one exception where we reopen the case. Which again intimates that, well, we are interested in truth. The verdict being passed is not the bottom line in every case. There are times where we will revisit it if there is reason to. Sanhedrin Nohegen. We said a Sanhedrin exists in Israel and outside. Man HaMile. How do I know I've got a Sanhedrin Chutz Laretz? Ditana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught. V'hayu Eile Lachem L'chukat Mishpat L'Dorateichem V'chol Moshvateichem is the end of the pasuk. You should have these principles of justice in place L'Dorateichem for all your generations in all your places. And it's worth pointing out, the Gemara doesn't include B'chol Moshvateichem, which Rashi and others say, oh, that's the proof text. But it's not here, so it sounds like actually L'Dorateichem is the proof text, that forever, justice is eternal. It's not just dependent on where you live or how you live, or whether you're in diaspora or not. Lamannu, we learn from here, Sanhedrin Shnogeh Baritz L'chutz Laretz, you have Sanhedrin in Israel and diaspora. Imkein Maltamud Lama B'Sha'arecha, why does the verse continue to say in your gates? Sounds like it's even more limited. B'Sha'arecha, because in your gates, meaning in Israel, you would have a bet din in every city, in every town. But in diaspora, only in every city, not in every town. Institutionally, there is a difference between Israel and Chutzlaretz, which again speaks to maybe why being in Israel would be different. The court system is more detailed. It's got more checks and balances. It's got more oversight that you wouldn't have in diaspora. Okay, now in the last straight. Sanhedrin HaRegit, we said a bet din that kills once every 7 years is murderous. And Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said once every 70 years. But he doesn't say is murderous. It's once every 70 years. The Gemara says, Ibailu, they asked, Achal Eshiv Mishani Nigret Chavlanit. Were you saying that, no, I disagree, one every 7 years is not just brutal, it's deeply brutal. Even one every 70 years is brutal. Oh, Dilma Orach Arahi. Or are you saying, yeah, the appropriate measure is one every 70 years? Teku. What does teku mean? There you go. It's seen as an acronym, Tishbi Yeshu Kushis Vobias, that the Tishbite, meaning Eliyahu Atishbi, Eliyahu will resolve all our issues. Teku literally means let it stand, meaning we don't know what he meant, which is, again, an odd way to do it. Usually this is meant in a legal context. I don't know how to resolve the case. This is just, I don't know what he meant. Who knows? But it seems to be there is a legal principle at stake here that we can't resolve. It's not just about what he said, but it's about what we feel. Tavri Mikiva Omerim Elu Hainu. Now we've got Rabbi Akiva's famous view. If I were on the Sanhedrin, was Rabbi Akiva on the Sanhedrin, by the way? So he was on the Sanhedrin, but we know that the capital punishment ceased being carried out 40 years before the destruction. So he wasn't involved in capital cases. They didn't adjudicate those anymore. But he said, if I won the Sanhedrin and we were even dealing with capital cases, no one would ever be put to death. And this is where the Gemara said, Rabbi Yochanan Rabbi Elazar, Damar Tavairi, Heichi Avi Avde. What would Rabbi Kiva do to make sure no one ever be put to death? Now, if you were a judge and you wanted to ask a question that no witness could ever answer, there was a murder case, and you wanted to ask a question that you know every time would get the murderer off, or at least not put to death, what could you possibly ask? That's what the Gemara is saying. How can Rabbi Kiva know that every case he would find a way to save them? You know, 12 angry men. You could have 11 angry men who aren't going to be persuaded. What can you ask that they would never be able to answer under oath? Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Elazar say, what would the two of them say? They would say, Re'itam Trefa Hareg, Shalom Hareg. Do you know whether they killed, the person they killed was a Trefa? Now, Trefa doesn't just mean not kosher to eat. Trefa, what does taref literally mean? The verb, la taref, means torn or ripped up. So when you're checking for a trefa in the laws of kosher, you're looking to see whether there are any tears in the body that would have meant the animal would have died within the next year. And if the animal was essentially would have died within the next year, it's called a trefa, which means it's not kosher, even if you shechted it properly, which is, I know in America, everybody does glut. A lot of places do glut kosher. In London growing up, that was not the norm. I don't know if it's become more the norm now.
Yes.
Oh, has it? Okay. Let's put it this way. It could be that people who grew up without that, it hasn't become the norm, but it's become more socially widespread. I grew up in a place called Edgware, where probably the butcher didn't do glut, but I probably now, if you go to Edgware, most of the butchers will say glut, and there's like a little section non-glut.
You will only certify glut.
The
OU.
Oh, so the OU will only certify glut. So I don't know what the London-based inn will do.
No, glut.
I know the Dayanim will only eat glut, but I don't know about...
Not even that, I'm pretty sure.
They just have fish, right. So I remember when I was in Israel, they had something called Lamb Day in Gush. I don't know if they did that back in the day, where they would have three sheep, and a shochet would come in, teach us the law of Shechita, and then they'd shech the three sheep, and they have a barbecue in the evening. Yeah, it traumatized a couple of the students.
And the sheep.
Well, not for long. But it did traumatize some of my friends for long. But it turned out two of the sheep ended up not being glut. And one was. And the British students, there were only like 11 of us, but we didn't do glut. And the 60 Americans had to share one sheep. And we got two between us. So it turned out well.
This just explains the traumatization. It was the Americans not getting enough
food. Yeah, they didn't get enough food. That was the trauma. So glut is seeing whether there are any bumps or lesions on the lungs that might indicate that it was going to die within the year. It's seen as a chumrah, or it was seen as a chumrah. It's now become pretty standard. And if you see glut milky restaurants, glut just means smooth. There are no lesions on the lungs. So glut doesn't mean anything when it comes to milky. So it's now code for frum. Yeah, super kosher. Rabbi Kiva's question is, Trefa, and this is like the legal fiction that if you've been given the guilty verdict, you're legally dead. If you're a Trefa, you're legally dead. So that's also true. If somebody is a Trefa, meaning there's one of 18 possible ways to identify, they're going to die within the next 12 months. This is not recommended. But if somebody is known that they're going to die within the next 12 months, if you kill them, you cannot be prosecuted under the law of capital punishment because they're legally dead. So Rabbi Kiva would come along and say, in a murder case, how do you know the person who you claim they murdered wasn't a trefa? Maybe we can't put him to death. At which point someone could turn around and say, I'm actually their physician. I've seen all the scans. They're fine. Rabbi Kiva goes, all right. So what would the response be? Amar Ravashi. Rashi says, Imtim Salama Shalim Hava. And if they come along and say, no, they weren't a trefa, I know they were fine. His question is, Dilma B'makam Sayef Nekev Hava. Says this isn't a day before scans. You were the doctor, and you said, actually, we've investigated the body. The whole body's in perfect shape, no trefa. And Rabbi Kiva says, well, hold on a minute. There's definitely one tear in the body. Where's there definitely a tear? Where the knife went in. How do you know that there wasn't a trefa tear right where the knife went in? Maybe it happens the murderer. In every case Rabbi Kiva would sit on, maybe it turns out in that one place where the knife went in, there was a signal of a trefa, and the person was going to die, not legally culpable. And this is going to raise the issue. It's like, well, hold on, you could say that about literally anything. We don't put to death on the basis of Rove. Truth. What happened to truth? And Rabbi Kiva seems to here bring a sort of judicial paralysis into play where you can't adjudicate anything because you could never know, which is the point about the 12 angry men. And then the Gemara says, well, hold on a minute. And in a minute, they're going to intimate, what would the rabbi say to disagree? Is there any pushback against that? Technically speaking, is it possible in every murder case that where the knife went in, there was a trafer that we can no longer identify because there's a knife wound? Technically speaking, is it possible? Yeah, technically it's possible. So maybe they're right. It's not dealt with right now, but we'll deal with the other case in a minute. Now, do we only put people to death for murder in Jewish law? No, capital punishment exists for all sorts of things. Shabbos, sexual impropriety, all sorts of cases. And the Gemara says, okay, Rabbi Kiva, you can get us on the whole trefa thing. What about sexual impropriety? What are you going to say there? Two witnesses say, we saw them having an affair. You can talk about trefa all you like, but that's not what's on the table here. The table is, those two were intimate, we saw it, what are you going to say? And this is, again, what you might think is an odd way to finish a chapter. But what would Rabbi Kiva say to stop us putting to death somebody who has been testified against and accused of adultery? Abaye v'Rava d'amar t'Avayu, Abaye said, this is what they would say. Re'item k'machachol b'shoshoferet. Did they see actual penetration? Did they see the actual act of intimacy? Or did they see two people in a room under the covers or something? Did they actually see the crime? Meaning if two people were spending time together and they weren't dressed, but they never actually engaged in sexual intimacy, there's no crime that you can prosecute. You know, I'd say yichud may have been over the line. You know, not recommended under the laws of yichud to do that. But you can't put them to death for adultery if they hadn't actually engaged in the sexual act. And Rabbi Kiva would say to the witnesses, did you see the sexual act? And they would say, oh, come on. They were in a room, there was romantic music playing. I saw them, you know, having a romantic dinner. What else do you think they were doing? Rabbi Kiva says, I don't know, but you want to put them to death. Are you willing to kill them? Because, come on, did you see it? At which point, Rabbanan Hechidainu, the whole judicial system has come to a stop now. And that's we're now in the last line of this perek, which we've said, justice is an approximation, truth is an approximation. If you take that to the end point, we're stuck. You can never adjudicate anything. You can never give out any punishment. What do the rabbis do? Dama Shmuel, they follow Shmuel. And Shmuel, and again, this seems like a very arbitrary ending to the Masechet, but it's going to establish this theme. What does Shmuel say? B'mana afim, kishu mashayiru k'mana afim. Says all they need to do is see that they're behaving like adulterers. Meaning, if they stand before the court and they say, we saw the two of them in a dark room, under the covers, we know what they were doing. I did not see the act of penetration. I cannot testify under oath that I know 100% they did this crime in a technical way. But I know what I saw, you know what I saw, and we're going to put them to death. Which seems like, again, an arbitrary way to end the perek. But it seems to be come to the point that for justice to work, we recognize there's approximation involved. And the rabbis are willing to execute justice. Again, maybe not put to death in the contemporary case, but in this era, the rabbis are saying, we would have been willing to put people to death on the basis of approximate truth. Even though Rabbi Kiva would say, they didn't see it. So what are you going to do? You're going to let society go crazy? Do whatever you want? No adjudication, no justice, no penalties? And that seems to be where we're led. Hadron Lachkeit said, Edem, that was the first chapter of Makos, which is talking about punishment in court, which is, sometimes it's approximate, but otherwise society, shofchei dam, you've got murder everywhere because no one can adjudicate cases. What we'll do next time is about exile, which is how do we determine when something's inadvertent or advertent. I'm glad I decided to stop there and not do any more. Next week we'll start that. In the meantime, I wish you all a wonderful week ahead, and I'll see you, please God, during the week. Benching.